Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
The story of a mysterious particle that eluded scientists for decades, and while it's still pretty hard to find, the neutrino continues to be a hot topic for scientists all over the world. That's including researchers from here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Their Antarctic Ice Cube project just won the 2013 Breakthrough of the Year Award from the British magazine Physics World. We're joined now by Ray Jayawardena. He's professor of astrophysics at the University of Toronto. He's got a new book out. It's called Neutrino Hunters, The Thrilling Chase for a Ghostly Particle to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. Ray, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is a neutrino?
A neutrino is an elementary particle. Neutrinos are incredibly tiny bits of matter. They are quite intriguing because of their characteristics. They carry no electric charge, and they zip right through our bodies and, in fact, right through the entire Earth and travel back into space. As every second of every day and night, trillions of these ghostly particles travel through our bodies. Luckily, they don't do any harm and they leave no trace.
This is one of the things I love about physics to the extent that I understand it. The neutrino, as you write, was discovered mathematically first, right? There was some missing energy that people were trying to account for, and they hypothesized that this thing was out there.
Indeed. A brash young physicist by the name of Wolfgang Pauli literally kind of conjured up this new particle in 1930 to solve a growing crisis in physics, where for decades people saw that whenever there was beta decay of radioactive elements, a type of radioactive decay, some energy seemed to go missing. And back then, this was a radical step because only two matter particles were known back then. And all of a sudden, he wanted to add a third with not a whole lot of direct evidence. So it was a big step. And in fact, soon afterwards, within a year or so, he made this comment that I have done a terrible thing. I have postulated a particle that cannot be detected. And it took some 25 years before physicists could trap it experimentally.
Why is it so hard to detect these things?
Because neutrinos hardly ever interact with any other particles. They are only subject to what's called the weak nuclear force or the weak interaction. So because they have no charge, they don't feel electromagnetism, and they're not subject to the strong nuclear force. So that means they, you know, hardly have a chance to interact with anything else. I describe them as pathologically shy, in fact, because of their tendency to not mingle.
We'll get into some of the efforts to detect neutrinos, including the Ice Cube project I mentioned. But first, what can neutrinos tell us about what's out there in space?
Quite a lot, in fact, and neutrinos can tell us about what's happening at the heart of the sun, the nuclear furnace that's producing the energy at the core of the sun. They can tell us about exploding stars far, far away because those explosions produce huge bursts of neutrinos. They are produced actually in the upper atmosphere of the Earth when particles from space called cosmic rays bombard us. And when those cosmic rays collide with atoms in the Earth's atmosphere, that produces neutrinos, and they are produced beneath our feet as well. The radioactive elements inside the Earth, as they decay, also produce neutrinos. So they're literally all around us, and they can tell us a lot about what's happening on a cosmic scale, but they have also taught physicists a great deal about the shenanigans of the subatomic world.
And I just saw a piece you wrote where you have seven possible uses for neutrinos and the likelihood. Can you give us a couple of likely things that we can use our understanding of neutrinos for here on planet Earth?
Indeed, these esoteric particles that we've studied until recently for their own sake might someday be of practical use here, right here on Earth. One of the most seriously investigated prospects is the idea of using neutrinos for nuclear proliferation monitoring. In other words, whenever a nuclear reactor is operating or whenever somebody tests a nuclear device, that would produce neutrinos. And there's no way to hide that because the neutrinos escape from their birth sites with hardly any loss. So they escape from where they're produced, and that means that if you could have a neutrino detector nearby a nuclear reactor, you could keep tabs on it. You could make sure that the people who are operating it aren't up to any mischief, that they're indeed doing what they claim to be doing. They're not switching the fuel rods too often, and really keep tabs on it. So it might give, for example, the International Atomic Energy Authority monitors another way of and a better way of keeping tabs on nuclear proliferation. There have been some other, perhaps what you might call wilder suggestions, including the idea of using neutrinos for communications, because they could traverse the Earth right through the core of the Earth instead of having to go around. You might save a few milliseconds if you could use neutrino beams to communicate from one side of the Earth to the other.
Well, talking about the nuclear proliferation issue reminds me of one of the early ways talked about to try to detect neutrinos. This one didn't seem very practical to do again and again. Somebody was going to have their detector set up underneath the detonation of a 20 megaton nuclear bomb.
Indeed. It does seem a far out idea right now. But the physicists who thought of this was back in the 1950s when for the first time physicists were trying to figure out ways of detecting neutrinos, they realized that nuclear detonations would be one of the most powerful sources of neutrinos. And for those physicists that were chasing neutrinos, it didn't seem that crazy because they had worked on the Manhattan Project. They were familiar with nuclear devices. So their first thought was, why not use the most powerful source of neutrinos we know of locally to detect them? Luckily, they didn't go forward with that scheme. Instead, they decided that they would try to detect neutrinos leaking from a nuclear power generator or nuclear reactor, where you don't get a huge burst, but you do have a continuous flux of neutrinos, and that's what succeeded.
Speaking of the Manhattan Project, that was a thing that a few governments actually had a big interest in, brought together a number of the best scientific minds they had available to them. A lot of personalities, a lot of people. The hunt for neutrinos, not as much, fewer and farther between. What motivated the people who were trying to detect those neutrinos?
Well, there was a lot of interest in neutrinos in the 1930s after Pauli had suggested their possible existence. But of course, with the advent of the Second World War, a lot of physicists on both sides of the Atlantic turned their attention towards the war effort. That meant, for the most part, neutrinos research took a back seat. But on the other hand, in the aftermath of the Second World War, some of these physicists were looking for new areas of research to pursue. They were looking for unsolved problems that they could take on. And that's when the interest in neutrinos returned. And in fact, some of the skills they had developed in the war effort, such as working with nuclear reactors and other devices, came in handy when it came time for them to think of clever ways of trapping these rather ghostly and elusive particles.
We're talking with Ray Jayawardena about the mysterious particle known as the neutrino. His new book is called Neutrino Hunters. Coming up, we'll talk about the efforts to detect it and the people who were in the hunt. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We have physicist Ray Jayawardena with us now. He is the author of the new book, Neutrino Hunters, talking about the hunt for the elusive subatomic particle called a neutrino. In just a few minutes, we'll talk about a Wisconsin connection by way of Antarctica. If you have a question, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Ray, a lot of colorful characters in this story. You mentioned Wolfgang Pauli, a brash young hotshot who came up with the idea of neutrinos. The hunt took a weird Cold War turn with, I'll mispronounce this for you, Ettore Majorana from Italy originally, I think.
Yes, indeed, there were a number of colorful characters. Ettore Majorana was one of them. This reclusive genius of a physicist was quite involved and interested in neutrino behavior. And one fine day, he disappeared without a trace at age 32. Presumably while on a boat from Sicily back to Naples, where he had a teaching position. There was no indication that he intended to commit suicide. His family never heard from him again. His colleagues never heard from him again. It's possible he jumped off the boat, but there were also lots of conspiracy theories surrounding his disappearance. People talked about the mob getting to him. Others talked about the possibility that he might have had a crisis of faith and joined a monastery, or that he may have absconded to South America. All sorts of stories swirling around his disappearance. In fact, it is said that for many years in Italy, there were Majorana sightings, kind of like Elvis sightings in the United States.
Oh, and I had actually rolled him up with Pontecorvo, another Italian who disappeared and ended up in the Soviet Union.
Indeed, at the height of the Cold War in 1950, with a lot of fear and worry about Red spies, this Italian physicist who had immigrated first to the United States, then to Canada, and finally to Britain, where he was working at an atomic research laboratory, while on vacation over the summer with his family on the European continent, all of a sudden went missing, and the whole family went missing, and there was a lot of fear that he had perhaps all along been a Russian spy, or at least that he had taken some nuclear secrets with him behind the Iron Curtain. It made headlines around the world, his disappearance. And a few years later, he did show up at a press conference in Moscow and talked about his decision to defect. So indeed, there were many, and those are just two of the colorful characters that I write about in Neutrino Hunters. People, you know, there's quite a cast of them that have been involved in neutrino research over the years.
Getting back to the hunt, it seems like all of the detection methods you describe, the first priority is to get underground. Why?
Great question. So the challenge of detecting neutrinos is twofold. One, because they hardly ever interact with anything, you need a very large volume for your detector. You need a very, a gigantic contraption. And the other is that there's a lot of noise around. In other words, there are a lot of other particles that you might confuse with the signals from neutrinos, the signals due to neutrinos. So you want to try to filter out the rest of that noise. The reason for going underground or indeed deep under the ice is to use the Earth itself or a thick layer of ice as a filter, because those other particles cannot penetrate through a mile or mile and a half of ground, and yet neutrinos have no trouble getting right through that. So you're in effect using the Earth or a thick layer of ice as a filter to filter out other particles and therefore hone in on the neutrinos.
You spent some time, I think it was a mile or more underground, in a nickel mine near Sudbury, Ontario. What was that like to be that far under the surface?
It was pretty exciting. I mean, it was, this is something that miners do every day, right? So we took the open cage down, the elevator cage down with the miners at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then trekked through some mile and a half of a tunnel, a muddy, dirty tunnel, to arrive at the world's deepest physics lab, where you go through this elaborate cleaning ritual. You change from your overalls, take a shower, change into a different set of overalls and a hairnet, and then walk through an air shower to get rid of any other remaining dust before you're allowed to enter the inner sanctum. And the inner sanctum is, you know, drastically different. It's incredibly clean. There's no dust in the air, shiny walls and floors. So quite a contrast from the grime of the mine outside. And the other ironic thing about it is this Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, as it's called, was built to peer at the heart of the sun. And it is deep underground where the sun never shines.
Hmm. To filter out all the cosmic rays and whatnot.
Exactly.
Well, let's visit Antarctica now. Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, operates the Ice Cube Observatory. How do they work? How are they different from that Sudbury operation?
The Sudbury operation and some of the other neutrino detectors consist of huge vats or tanks filled with either dry cleaning fluid or heavy water or some other medium that traps neutrinos, or you hope that a few neutrinos would interact with the atoms of that medium. In the case of Ice Cube, it's quite a brilliant design where the scientists are using the ice itself as the medium of the detector, of the neutrino detector, and they had to go deep enough under the South Pole so that there are no air bubbles trapped in the ice. They needed the ice to be very clear and very clean, and that way when a neutrino interacts with an atom in the ice, it produces another particle called a muon, and when a muon travels through the ice, it leaves a faint blue trail. That is the trail that tells you that a neutrino has just arrived. In other words, you're not seeing the neutrino directly. You're getting a whiff of its presence by its interaction. And the scientists took a risky gamble and an expensive one in building this novel detector. They had a predecessor instrument called Amanda that they had worked with and tested. And Ice Cube really is starting to pay off already. They've sunk literally some 5,000 optical sensors into the ice. They drilled really deep holes into which they lowered cables with these optical sensors, kind of basketball-sized optical sensors hanging on those cables. And they're now permanently buried in the ice, and the Ice Cube Observatory works beautifully. It's the world's biggest neutrino detector at the moment. And as you might know, just in the past month or so, they've announced some of their first results.
What have they found? What was the news from their results?
The news is that they've detected neutrinos coming from far outside our solar system for only the second time in history. They just reported only the second batch of neutrinos ever seen from beyond our solar system. The first set of neutrinos was back in 1987 when a supernova exploded in a satellite galaxy of the Milky Way. That's 2 dozen neutrinos that were detected by 3 different neutrino detectors around the globe. What Ice Cube has detected are some 28 events so far in the first 2 years of its operation. That's not a very a large rate. It's about one neutrino detection per month, roughly speaking, and yet it's quite a big deal because now that marks the beginnings of neutrino astronomy, the detection of energetic cosmic neutrinos that might soon tell us something about some of the most violent corners and phenomena of the universe, because we expect these neutrinos probably come from either supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies or from the death of very massive stars.
Ray, your book is partly about neutrinos, but it's partly about how science happens, as I'm reading it. And there's just so much coincidence. One of the main teams in this got together because they happened to be stuck in the same airport for a while. One key figure was a philosophy major who took a physics class and decided that was his thing. Just a lot of little stories like this. Are there things we can learn from the successes of the neutrino hunt that could inspire the science of the future?
For sure. I mean, I think it's the reason I was motivated and inspired to write this book is the richness of the history, the personalities, and the science. And it tells you that science is very much a human endeavor. It moves in surprising ways and with surprising twists. And scientists who are involved in the neutrino hunt are very much, you know, people of the world. They're affected by world wars. They, you know, sometimes have to emigrate for family reasons. They have these unexpected encounters with colleagues that, you know, where conversations lead to new ideas. It's very much about the process of science. And also, the other reason for bringing out this book right now is the, as marked by the Ice Cube discovery, the very recent discovery, neutrino research is really making it in prime time now. It's really opening up new directions and new insights about both the subatomic world and the universe at large.
Ray, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Rob.
That's Ray Jayawardena. He's a physicist, and his new book is Neutrino Hunters.